This ministry is supported by the members and friends of First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. If you would like to support future podcasts, go to www.ucdsm.org to make your contribution.
Over the years that we participate in a church, we are afforded the opportunities to know people we may otherwise have not met. We get to know them in classes, in small groups, conversations after services, in meetings, in the midst of church projects and social action events. Sometimes these people become our friends, and sometimes they remain as acquaintances that we only know on a surface level. And yet, being part of a church family, we call them our own, and we value the ways their lives do intersect with ours. Over time, many of us begin to see that this church family can be one of the richest families of our lives, both for what we do know and for what we come to know and reflect upon after our friends here make their final exit from this life. Each year we say farewell to some, sharing in storytelling and celebrations of life that teach us or remind us of things we may need to know. And thereby, the wisdom carried by each of us gets passed on to those who remain. One of the many privileges of our ministry together, then, is the opportunity to learn from the lives of those who share our church and to celebrate the living that we have shared with them. And so, as is now our custom at this Festival of Remembrance service, we'll share reflections about the members of our church who have died in the past year. May you be enriched by these remembrances, finding in them nuggets of wisdom or memory that you may carry with you in the days to come. Today we begin by remembering and lighting a candle for Jeannie Bowles, who died on December 29th at the age of 65. Most of us who knew Jeannie met her when she became administrator of our church early in my ministry, a role she held for about 4 years. She served during a time of rapid growth in our church when we were understaffed and it was challenging to keep up with all the curveballs. She did her best. One of the gifts she brought to her work with us was her ability to know people. She befriended many and appreciated the opportunities to be social that her role provided. One of her favorite tasks as administrator was to be present on Sundays and greet the children. Even after she was no longer employed by the church, she continued to participate with us, including occasionally attending our former Saturday services and serving as a coming-of-age mentor. Jeannie loved cats, and truth be told, she had some cat-like qualities herself. Maybe that's why she loved them so much. She understood them. She understood their need for solitude, their need for control of their circumstances, and the privilege of earning their trust. I know that Jeannie was well received by cats and that she deeply cared about them and their well-being, taking in foster cats and, in one instance, helping to socialize a particularly tough case that was hiding in her friend Lori's garage. Jeannie apparently knew just how to sweet-talk him to get him to come out. I'm guessing many of us who knew her experienced Jeannie's sweet talk ourselves from time to time, how she would remember odd details about us and offer them to us to let us know that she was paying attention and that she cared. A natural flirt, Jeannie enjoyed playful banter and double entendre, and she was always in search of her Prince Charming, even as she may have appreciated being a lifelong bachelorette even more. One of my favorite topics to discuss with Jeannie was Cleveland Indians baseball. One of her extended family members, Casey Blake from Indianola, played third base for the Indians while Jeannie and I worked together. I can't say she'd be rooting for Cleveland in this World Series, but she would appreciate that they were there. I miss Jeannie, and I know all who knew her miss her too, maybe more than we realize. Her death offered us yet another reminder to take the opportunities to tell those we love why and to appreciate the little things that sometimes make our challenging lives a bit more bearable. Today, we remember and light a candle for David Hurd, who died on February 6th at the age of 86. A native of Chicago, Dave moved to Des Moines with a friend following their time in the Army to start a furniture-making business, but he ended up being hired at Bankers Life, thus beginning a 40-year career at the firm, which later became Principal Financial. It was at Bankers Life that he met his first wife, Patricia. Together, they raised 3 children and endured ups and downs with Patsy's health along the way, even as Dave climbed the career ladder. Before retiring from principal in 1994, Dave had served as president, CEO, and chairman, helping lead the company into the international market. One of the achievements that endeared him to all fair-minded people in town was his leadership to remove barriers to employment based on sexual orientation. Always driven by common sense, Dave could see no purpose in blocking potential candidates for employment based on who they loved. He was very public in his advocacy for the LGBT community, and he encouraged other business leaders in town to do the same. After 40 years of marriage to Patsy, she finally succumbed to the cancer that had wanted to claim her life many times over the years. Around the time of her death, Dave wrote to his adult children a letter letting them know that were he to face health challenges that would take away his quality of life, that would leave him stuck with a bleak and hopeless future, he would choose to end it on his terms. Around this time, he started attending our church, finding here a life philosophy and ethical approach that closely matched his own. He was a generous and humble participant in the life of our congregation, always stepping up when needed without expectations of special treatment. Following Pat's death, Dave was also clear in his desire for companionship and returned to his search for a mate. Never one to care about convention, he placed a personal ad in the Des Moines Register that read, "Retired executive, widower, trim athlete, culturally and politically active with wide interests, seeking equally trim, active, intelligent soulmate, age 50 to 70. A local real estate agent, Barb Brubaker, was intrigued by this ad. She listened to the recording of the man who had written the ad and decided to give him a call, leaving her own message, a message that Dave later said was so unprepared and unfocused in its rambling that he couldn't help but be interested in hearing more. He just had to call her back. He did, and they agreed to meet at Java Joe's. He said she would be able to identify him if she looked for the guy with the ponytail. Right then, she knew she'd set up a date with Dave Hurd. In January of 2002, in a simple ceremony for just the closest of family and friends, Dave and Barb were married in Mary Safford room, actually. They shared a joyous first few years of marriage, traveling all over the world, building treasured memories. Within a few years, Barb was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and so David had to transition once again from husband to caregiver, a role he had known when Patsy had been challenged by her illnesses. A few months before Barb died, Dave found himself in a quandary. Now in his 80s, he wondered if his life was over, or if he still had some more living to do. He sought out my counsel as his minister, as well as the feedback of his doctor and his family, asking us if it would be okay if he were to pursue another relationship. We all said without hesitation, yes, of course, that's what Barb would want, and we gave him our blessings. He invited a Prairie Club friend, Trudy Holman, to coffee. Trudy had known Dave for nearly 10 years at this time and had enjoyed his company and conversation at their monthly Prairie Club meetings, but she did not anticipate the date for coffee was anything more than a friendly chat. But Dave was direct, as was his way. He told her he was not done living and he wanted to pursue a relationship with her. She found she wanted the same, and on a sunny August afternoon in 2012 in the Sculpture Park downtown, they were wed. Shortly after they were married, it became evident to them both that something was not right physically with Dave. After several tests and evaluations over many months, it was determined that he likely had Lewy body's disease, a neurodegenerative dementia similar to Parkinson's, that was not something that could be cured, only endured, as it took more and more of Dave's functioning. They didn't widely tell people about this situation, and they made the best of it. They continued to go out and attend events, but the decline in Dave's health was evident to most. Family and friends could see the decline, but Dave put on a brave face, rising to the occasion, doing his best to enjoy his remaining days. And yet, knowing his earlier declaration that he would take his life were his future to become so bleak that no other choice made as much sense, we must wonder how his decline weighed on his spirit. His body had been his temple his whole life, and now it was being slowly taken from him. Had he the option of a more dignified exit from this life, if a medical approach could have been legally sought, we can be confident that he would have chosen it. He would not have made the choice to leap off the patio of his apartment at the plaza. He could have had the humane send-off that his great humanity deserved. Given how Dave lived his life, given how he was not afraid to stand up for what he believed and to encourage others to do the same, given how he was an advocate for compassion and fairness in human relations, perhaps one of the legacies of his life and his choice of death will be that those who knew him well will stand up for the choice that he didn't have, and that others, and maybe we ourselves, may one day want to have, and that is the choice to die with dignity. What we can know is that regardless of how Dave died, he lived a full life of meaning and purpose, a life that impacted his community in ways beyond measure. We know that his extraordinary and generous life can be an example for all of us, appreciating our agency in the world and contributing what we can to ensure that others have the same opportunities. And we know that even as Des Moines and the people he loved will not be the same without him, the legacy of his life and his love will live on.
Today we remember and light a candle for Phyllis Briley, who died on March 1st at the age of 81. She grew up in Decatur County during the Depression on a farm, later moving into Des Moines after high school. Phyllis was a strong woman who defied the conventions of her time to live her life her own way. As a girl, she had been an athlete playing basketball. At a time when girls were limited to playing on only one half of the court so as not to exhaust themselves. But that did not stop her. Later in life, she was a single mother and a business owner, all while putting herself through school. She joined this church in the 80s, raising her kids here. She served alongside us on the care crew, making meals for others in need, working in our church gardens, and participating in Unity Circle. Her children say she was the strength when we needed it. She protected all six of her children like a mama bear, which included the children she gained in marrying her husband, Dale. She even welcomed his first wife to their family gatherings. Family was family, and family was central to the meaning of her life. Despite having 15 grandchildren and 6 great-grandkids, she paid attention to the particulars of each of their lives, knowing who played what and what team they played on and who to cheer for. She never forgot a birthday, nieces and nephews included. She loved bringing people in her family together, whether it was out swimming on the farm or fishing there, sharing a pig roast on the 4th of July, or helping to birth animals. It is clear that she stood by her family whenever they would let her. In fact, her last outing out of her home was to accompany her granddaughter to an ultrasound. The sonographer told the parents to look away and wrote the baby's sex on a piece of paper and gave it to Phyllis. Ashley wanted her grandmother to know, and Phyllis was able to be there for her despite her struggles with her own illness. She was struggling with the very same cancer that had killed her own mother at the age of 59. She showed great bravery in her fight, and for a while she was in remission. But when it returned, her cancer claimed her life on March 1st. Today, we remember and light a candle for Eileen Lundberg, who died on June 18th at the age of 70. Eileen was a beloved member of this community and of the larger community. She was an alive woman, alive for her own life and for the lives of this church, of her family, of her friends, the larger community. She grew up on the north side of Des Moines city limits in a rural area where she was known to play around in the sweet corn and the 500 tomato plants. And this experience sparked in her a love of gardening and the outdoors that stayed with her throughout her life. When she was just a child, her mother was injured, and Eileen took over many of her mother's caregiving responsibilities. She then married her husband, Dan, at the age of 16. And the day before her 17th birthday, she gave birth to her first child, James. In many ways, she missed out on her adolescent years, moving into adulthood rather quickly. Despite this, she delighted in her role as a wife, as a mother, as a grandmother. She was married for 53 years, had 2 children, 3 grandchildren. She enjoyed being a grandmother, and she wanted her grandchildren to be well-rounded people. So she took them to plays, museums, and gardens, helped pay for camps, trips, and horns. One of her great joys at the end of her life was that she got to spend a week with her grandson. If you had the chance to go out to her home, you know that she created a beautiful home and gardens. She placed interesting things in every corner of her home, and the layers of landscaping were just remarkable. Her husband, Dan, said that most of Eileen's ideas involved some dirt and a shovel. And he remembers that once when they were working outside on a hot day, she turned to him to say, "I love you when you're sweating." It was common to find Eileen, Dan said, at the window looking out over her gardens as she ate her breakfast, only to look out the window a few moments later and see her bending over, pulling out weeds as she drank her coffee. Eileen loved to learn. She took notes and carried pen and paper with her all the time. She had piles of magazines in her home about gardening, sewing, cooking, landscaping, quilting, and others. And she also had drawers filled with pages that she had pulled out from these magazines with projects she intended to do. Her husband, Dan, said that if she lived 500 years, she wouldn't have been able to complete all the projects she was imagining. Eileen, she simply loved life. You could see it in her face. You could see it in the stories her family told and her love of the state fair. She went about 3 to 4 times each year from morning until night in order to experience all of it and get her fill. She made the outings an adventure, always looking for the new and the unusual. One year, she won the bubble blowing contest in 1986. And once, she and her sister made life-size paper dolls of themselves to take around the fair. So imagine this. They laid down paper. They traced each other. They cut it out. They stuffed it with paper and glued it together. And then they put them in the front seat of their cars and buckled them in and then took them on the fair. They took them on rides. They took them everywhere they went. Eileen was a devoted church member here as both a volunteer and an activist. Some of us have received her detailed emails that she would send coordinating our hospitality teams, noting the particular mix of medium and dark roast to make when you're serving coffee, and when exactly she would prefer that you drop off the treats. She was often in our kitchen washing dishes, smiling, and enjoying herself. She also had a passion for social justice and the rights of those who were marginalized. She frequented anti-war rallies, and at one, she was carrying a coffin. Other times, she couldn't attend an event, but she would show up here at the church at the end to help clean up or do the dishes just to show her support. Eileen's struggle escalated this past winter once she had finally received an accurate diagnosis of pulmonary fibrosis, and it took many of us by shock. She declined quickly, losing the ability to walk and to breathe, and she was frustrated that this meant that she wouldn't be able to do the many, many projects she had planned on doing once she was confined to her bed. But she didn't let this ruin her spirits and overtake her. She found ways to keep enjoying life, no matter how hard the daily routine of life had become. And this doesn't mean that she never got grouchy or frustrated. She was human. But overall, she embraced the changes in her life with courage and self-compassion in a way that I've never been privileged to know before. I last saw her about 10 days before she passed, and when I entered her room at Kavanaugh House, she had her eyes closed. Her body had grown increasingly frail and thin, and she was struggling to breathe. When her husband walked in, she opened her eyes. And then, if you know Eileen, that familiar spark poured forth from her eyes and her smile lit up her room and her body. She energized her own frail body with her warmth and her radiance, and I felt comforted. I thought I was there to comfort her, but Eileen is full of love and comfort. And she faced her death as she lived her life with grace. I was changed by the way she embraced the rapid changes and decline of her life. And I don't think it's possible if any of you were able to go and be with her in her time of need, that you wouldn't have been changed by her too. She leaves this inspiring legacy of care and self-compassion and vitality. May we all draw close her radiant love and recommit ourselves to live in our own light as she did.
Today we remember and light a candle for Shirley Atkin, who died on June 17th at the age of 88. Only our most veteran members of the church are likely to remember Shirley. She hasn't attended services much since the late 80s, but those who do remember her will no doubt recall her keen mind, her spirited way, and her passionate heart. A native of Des Moines, Shirley found the church in the 1960s with her husband, Bruce. She had attended Simpson College and had completed studies at Chicago Theological Seminary, so when she was offered the role of Director of Religious Education here during the ministry of John Isom, she accepted and excelled. Her experience, leadership, and management skills here at the church caught the eye of Planned Parenthood of Iowa, and they approached her about running the place. This opportunity was a watershed moment for Shirley, a position of great responsibility with politics and protests and scary situations, and she was in charge. This is when Shirley became a champion for women's health and women's rights. Together, she and Bruce had three children, and through them, four grandchildren. The couple eventually retired to their cabin at Lake Red Rock. Upon Bruce's death in 1987, Shirley had a tough time adjusting, but within a few years found a second chance at love and companionship with a man named Alvin Leong. Together, they became professional snowbirds, spending their summers in Pella and their winters in Hawaii. Following Al's death, Shirley lived her last year at Scottish Rite Park in Des Moines. Shirley was a woman before her time, whose hard work in women's rights changed things for the better. Her family and friends may have lost her, but the universe has gained a force to be reckoned with. Today we remember and light a candle for Des Bragg, who died on July 31st at the age of 98. Desmond Bragg was born the fourth of six kids, but he did not grow up knowing his parents. After his mother was institutionalized in a mental hospital, his father placed four-year-old Des in an orphanage where he would spend most of his childhood. As a teen, Des lived for a few years with foster parents who ran and operated a dairy farm in Texas. Soon after he started high school, the Depression was bearing down and the farm was failing, so Des decided to take off on the open road, leaving town on a midnight freight train headed for Enid, Oklahoma, where he thought he could stay for a while with his uncle's family. Seeing that they could not support him there, he traveled by foot and train to another uncle in Kansas, where again he was turned away. Hungry, tired, and desperate, he eventually landed in Denver, where he was hired by the Civilian Conservation Corps to plant trees and clear trails. While in Denver, he returned to high school but felt like an outsider among his more affluent classmates, and he was not doing well in his classes, so again he decided to head out on his own, this time choosing to enlist in the infantry at Fort Warren in Cheyenne, Wyoming. After 2 years of serving, Des left the Army to enroll at North Park College and Academy in Chicago to complete his education and pursue life as a minister in the Swedish Covenant faith. He described the faith he had when he began at North Park as a simple but wholehearted belief in a fundamentalist version of Christianity. But after reading Emerson and Kant, and perhaps most importantly, William James, Des discovered that he had more questions about faith than answers. Meanwhile, with the atrocities of World War II raging, he could no longer easily accept the notion of a loving God who would let these things happen. Even as he struggled with his faith and his fitness for the ministry, he accepted the opportunity to serve as an intern minister for a small church in Conover, Wisconsin, where he would meet his future wife and soulmate, Jean. Des's doubts about his faith and future ministry persisted, and he made the difficult decision to leave his seminary training to again enlist in the armed forces, this time in the Navy. Following his time in the service, Des and Jean moved several times in Wisconsin as they both taught school, and Des completed his bachelor's, master's, and eventually doctoral degrees in education at the University of Wisconsin. While in Wisconsin, the couple had three kids, and Des worked as a principal for different schools. In 1960, the family moved to Des Moines, where Des had been hired as an assistant professor of school administration at Drake, the university where he worked until his retirement in 1983, and where Jean and all three of their children earned their degrees. A few years past retirement, an accident in his yard left Des paralyzed and wheelchair-bound, which is how many of us knew him. For someone who had grown reliant upon physical exercise for his health and spirit, the loss of his mobility must have been crushing. Yet he carried on in good spirits with Jean's help and put together exercise regimens that would keep him healthy for all but the final days of his life. Gene's death in 2005 was a great loss for Des, and I know he was grateful to his daughter Claudia for living with him and for caring for him so that he could stay in the home that he loved. Even a brief summary of Des's life would be incomplete without a mention of one of his greatest interests. In 1951, while driving in northern Wisconsin with Gene and their kids, they saw a metallic streak of light flashing across the sky ahead of them. Des did not forget the encounter, and he spent the rest of his life researching other tales of unidentified flying objects, finding in his search promises of an open door to the cosmos and meaning that would take humankind beyond what we have previously known. In 2002, he co-authored a book entitled The UFO Enigma, which offered a summary of what he believed to be the most reliable UFO research and documents. He was convinced in the likelihood of these UFOs being of alien origin and believed we would all one day come to the same conclusion. Maybe in his quest for the truth of UFOs, Des was continuing his search for a reliable faith, a faith that might hold more answers than the faith he had relinquished in his younger days. Des found a home for what had become an existentialist and humanistic faith here at the Unitarian Church, where he was a member for more than 50 years. Throughout the 15 years of my time here, Des was reliable both in his attendance and his encouragement of our congregation's ministry. He was a fine storyteller, enthusiastic listener, and a good friend. All those who knew him here miss him for sure. And today, finally, we remember and light a candle for Carol Evans, who died on August 31st at the age of 86. Carol was born in Plainfield, Illinois, an only child to parents who impressed upon her the importance of being active in the community. She studied at Northern Illinois Teacher College, where she first met her future husband, Bob, in an astronomy class. After completing her degree, Carol got a job teaching in Kirkland, Illinois, thus beginning more than three decades as an educator. One February weekend, Carol was driving back to Kirkland after visiting her parents in nearby Lamont when she was involved in an accident that broke her jaw and landed her in the hospital for several days. Meanwhile, Bob, not forgetting his friend Carol, had written a letter that Carol's mother brought to the hospital. Back in touch again now, the couple enjoyed a quick courtship and wed on September 1st, 1951. Almost immediately, Carol was pregnant with the couple's first daughter, with a second to follow a few years later. For the next decade, the family moved wherever Bob could find a better teaching salary than the previous year, which meant the family moved 9 times in 10 years. In 1962, the family moved to Des Moines, where Bob had a job waiting for him in the education department of Drake University. Carol held various positions for the Des Moines Public Schools during her career, including teaching English at Hoyt and Callanan Middle Schools, and several years as a vice principal at Hoyt. She was a leader in the National Association of Middle-Level Educators, both locally and nationally. The family had a tradition of spending the summer in Colorado, eventually purchasing land about 45 miles southwest of Denver in the foothills of the Rockies. In the 1970s, Bob and Carol, who enjoyed going to auctions and antique shopping, started an antique business near their summer home in Colorado, eventually moving the business closer to Des Moines. They ran the shop together for the next dozen years or so until Bob's stroke in 2004 led them to sell the business. Carol was Bob's primary caregiver until his death in 2007. Carol's daughters were a driving force in her life. Her concern for them was a constant, and her attempts to successfully navigate her relationships with them a challenge. The truth is, there were family dynamics at play that no one really understood. But one fact is undisputable. No matter what transpired in their family history, Carol never stopped loving her daughters and yearned for the times when she could be assured of their love as well. Another great source of meaning in Carol's life was her participation in this church and the many role models she found here, how she valued the UU message that we must be responsible participants in our community. It was this responsibility that helped foster her interest in and support of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, the efforts toward our church becoming a welcoming congregation for LGBT folks, and her steadfast involvement with and support of the Des Moines Habitat for Humanity. She was instrumental in the development, growth, and protection of our church endowment. One church leader described her passion for the endowment as similar to a mother grizzly protecting her cubs in defense. Some of us recall how many years ago Carol assumed that the Board of Trustees of the church did not really understand the endowment fund, and so in her best teacher role, she came to the board meeting and gave them a 10-question quiz. Everyone flunked badly. when during a capital campaign here over a decade ago, I suggested that we consider either using or borrowing from our endowment, Carol put up fierce but friendly opposition. I still remember the meeting I shared with her in her home, during which we talked at length about her concerns. It was a long conversation. The truth is, every congregation needs people like Carol Evans, people who care passionately about the place, who will silently and selflessly contribute when needed, and who will respectfully speak up when they think circumstances are not being handled wisely or fairly. A few years back, Carol underwrote the purchase of a fine set of handbells that are played in our services monthly and that are now one of her lasting legacies to our church. Each time they ring, we will recall our classy, intelligent friend with the big heart and the radiant smile, and we can remember that what we give to this, our religious community, can endure beyond our lives. Hearing the stories of those from our church family who have died in the past year may have also brought to mind other lives that have touched your own. So let us now share a litany of memory for all those whom you hold dear in your memory. Please turn in your hymnals to reading 720, 720. As we make our way from this place back out into the world, this world where we are called to love and, when necessary, to let go, we are reminded of the words of Mary Oliver. To live in this world, she says, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends upon it, and when the time comes, to let it go. To let it go. I extinguish the symbolic flame of this gathering. May we carry its light into the world.